This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Today we analyze the state of the free press and civil liberties in the United States. We'll kick things off with Sue Wilson, founder of Media Action Center, about the private censorship of public airwaves and the FCC's possible ruling, deciding whether or not right-wing radio is bona fide news. Then legendary free press proponent and documentary filmmaker John Pilger joins us from London for a commentary on the state of the free press. And we close out the show with Bo Hodai, author of a new study published by the Center for Media and Democracy, Dissent or Terror? How the Nation's Counterterrorism Apparatus, in partnership with Corporate America, Turned on Occupy Wall Street. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Today's program, we focus on free press and civil liberties concerns. We'll kick things off here with Sue Wilson of the Media Action Center. Later on this morning, we'll hear from John Pilger, and we'll finish the program with Bo Hodai talking about a new study, Dissent or Terror, published by the Center for Media Democracy. So here's Peter to introduce Sue Wilson. Peter.
Sue Wilson is a media activist. She's director of the Public Interest Pictures Broadcast Blues and a 22-year veteran of broadcast journalism. She's won numerous awards, including an Emmy. She's worked at CBS, PBS, Fox, and NPR, and she's editor of the media criticism blog, Sue Wilson Reports, and founder of the Media Action Center. Sue, are you with us?
I am. Hello, Peter.
Good to talk to you. You've been active up in Wisconsin monitoring some of their big radio stations up there and their coverage of the attempted recall of the governor up there, and found that some of these stations were very biased. Tell us what you found.
Yeah, it's not just that they were biased. What we find in the Milwaukee general area, and, you know, when we talk Milwaukee, we're talking the radio stations that also promote Paul Ryan. What we found in that area is that there are five local talk radio shows that are on the air 15 hours a day, Monday through Friday. As might be expected, those local talk radio shows are, quote, conservative. And that's fine. They have a right to get on the air and talk about their ideology. However, they crossed a line, Peter. What they've been doing, and when I say they, WISN, a Clear Channel station, and WTMJ, a Journal Communication station, 50,000 watts each, these two giant stations throughout the Scott Walker recall actually used the airwaves to specifically promote Scott Walker, to tell people to vote for Scott Walker, to tell people, here's where you can go to volunteer for Scott Walker. Now, what we did was we actually got people with stopwatches recording these shows and monitoring exactly how many minutes per day this went on. What we discovered is that between the two stations, it was 160 minutes every single day of direct promotion of Scott Walker to be elected as governor. At the same time, though, there were Democrats, supporters of the opponent, Tom Barrett, who were writing in asking for comparable time. And the station specifically said, no, you can't be on the air. The only people we're putting on the air are people who are for Scott Walker.
Sue Wilson, this is Mickey Huff. Thanks for joining us this morning.
This gets
even more interesting here. Some of our listeners may remember something called the Fairness Doctrine that ended supposedly under the Reagan years there. That's 1987. But you write in your recent pieces, and these were published too on the Brad blog, Brad Friedman, whom we've worked with at Project Censored. You found something called the Zapple Doctrine. Could you talk to us about this and how this is not just a potential violation of the First Amendment, but there's this other FCC rule that many people don't know about.
That's right. I mean, I think when I told the story, people instantly go, well, that doesn't seem right. It isn't right, and it's not only, it's against the law. Let me get into it this way. There is a law on the books. It is called the Equal Time Rule. If you are a candidate running for office, and a broadcaster puts your opponent on the air, you are also entitled to equal time on that radio station. The FCC's role is to write rules then to enforce the law. So the FCC wrote a rule that expanded the equal time rule to not just candidates, but supporters of candidates. So if there's a surrogate of a candidate on the air talking about his candidate and how great the candidate is, well, surrogates of the other candidate are supposed to be allowed on the air. That is called the quasi-equal opportunities rule, or Zappel Doctrine. So really, these stations in Wisconsin have clearly violated this FCC rule. The trick is, the FCC hasn't had a challenge on this rule for 30 years, and they're not sure that they really want to enforce it, because really, the FCC does not want to enforce any of its rules that protect the public interest.
So why would you say that's happening? And you filed an urgent complaint with FCC, and they have, to my understanding, not responded to that. So why are they dragging their feet?
You know, I'm going to use a term I've learned recently called regulatory capture. What that means is that the regulator has been captured by those it is supposed to be regulating. And what I see, and I've been following this since 1998, this is not anything new. What I see is that the FCC really cozies up to the lobbyists for the big media corporations that are knocking on their door every day in Washington, D.C., whereas we, the people out here who are fighting the good fight and saying, wait a minute, we own these public airwaves. We're entitled to be on the radio during campaigns. If you're going to put one candidate on, you have to put the other on. But they're just not used to the public really standing up and shouting and fighting for us.
So, Sue Wilson, you've been writing about this for at least a year, the Scott Walker issue, and you cited this is also of interest to us because I don't know, some folks that pay attention to industry or broadcast industry publications like Radio Inc. and some others, you actually caught their attention, and they started attacking you about these issues, even though you had argued this quite well. That basically was a straw person argument that they were conducting. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about this Supreme Court case, the Red Lion v. FCC, because it states here that the First Amendment does not protect private censorship by broadcasters who are licensed by the government to use a scarce resource, which is denied others. And that's what you're explaining here.
Absolutely. And the Supreme Court of these United States has come down again and again, and the Red Lion case goes back to 1969, but even the Roberts Supreme Court has come down saying that broadcasting is very special because there are scarce frequencies. There's only so many frequencies in our air over which a radio station can broadcast, and those airways are owned by all of us. Therefore, broadcasting does get to be regulated to ensure that all of our rights are upheld. Now, when we look at that Red Lion First Amendment case, it's very clear that, yes, a radio station does have a First Amendment right. A radio host can get on the air and say pretty much what they like. But what they can't do and what they have been doing, they cannot prohibit members of the public from getting on the air and having their say, especially during elections. It is violating the First Amendment rights of all of those people who are denied access to the big microphones.
So, Sue, these two stations, WINSN and WTMJ in Wisconsin, covering probably the entire state, were really promoting Scott Walker exclusively in their talk host shows. And you filed an FCC complaint. They responded by saying that these were bona fide news shows. Is that correct? And what did they mean by that?
Well, let's go back to that original law that I was talking about, the equal time law, okay? There is an exception to the equal time law that if a candidate, or rather, is that if a station is a bona fide news program, they don't have to give equal time. Now, that's kind of counterintuitive, but if you think of it this way, if, for example, During a presidential election, Mitt Romney comes through the Bay Area for a big event. The news stations want to be able to go out and cover that event without worrying that now they have to give equal time to Barack Obama. When Barack Obama wasn't in the Bay Area, he was over in Texas or somewhere else. It frees up a real news station to be able to cover live time events in their areas. What these, and this is a real Hail Mary pass from these stations, what they're arguing is that, oh, well, we can do what we like on our air with our talk radio hosts, which are, you know, your typical conservative, all one way, Rush Limbaugh style hosts. They're arguing that those shows are bona fide news. And we are really pitching a fight over this one. Well,
this is interesting, Sue Wilson. So, and in your piece, again, this is what has been coming up, and this is how Radio Inc. got into this as well. Basically, the question then is Rush Limbaugh as much of a bona fide news provider as, say, you know, historically Walter Cronkite was? That was one of the examples that was used. And we won't use this as a platform to get into Walter Cronkite, per se, or corporate media, or, you know, any of the networks or what have you. But the point is the term bona fide news is purportedly making a difference, right, between the 90-odd percent of talk radio that's right-wing claiming that it's bona fide news versus any remote pretense of objectivity.
Yes, and let's not forget that really part of the goal with these talk radio stations is to confuse the public about what is news and what is opinion. That has been an agenda, according to David Brock, who founded Media Matters, for more than a generation. And, you know, it's working. A few years ago, Pew Research reported that 22% of Americans believe that talk radio is bona fide news. It's critical that we start to draw a line right now saying, no, there is journalism, there is reporting, and then there is opinion, based on information, but opinion. What we'd really like to see the FCC do is to come down and say stations need to label what is news and what is opinion. So there's a clear line like you might find in a newspaper's editorial page.
All right, so Sue Wilson, Obama's FCC head, Tom Wheeler, might be chiming in on this?
There is no question that the FCC commissioners will have to decide the underlying Zappel Doctrine case. They're going to have to decide this. The question is, are they going to decide this in the next 6 months or in the next 6 years? There is no timetable for them to act. And that is part of why we are putting as much pressure on the FCC as we can to say, the people of Wisconsin cannot afford to go through many more elections with this one-sided assault on the Democrats.
So, Sue, you have a petition online, tell the FCC talk radio is not bona fide news. How do people get involved in that?
Go to our website, Google Media Action Center or mediaactioncenter.net. You can find it at the very top of the page. You can also find all of the legal documents. We have filed a petition to deny the license of these stations. You'll see their responses. But, yes, that very important petition is at the very top of the Media Action Center website.
Sue Wilson, thanks so much again for joining us, and thanks for keeping us apprised of this very important issue about the significance of the free press and, you know, really what's going on here. And I think more importantly, Sue Wilson, also trying to tell the public what we can do about it, how we can reclaim the airwaves.
Well, thank you, Project Centered, for being you.
Thanks a lot, Sue.
After this short musical break, we'll be joined by John Pilger. Please stay with us.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We are joined now by John Pilger in London. John Pilger, of course, is the award-winning filmmaker and journalist with 60 films. His most recent film, The War You Don't See, was actually censored by the Liberal Landon Foundation in the U.S., an irony of epic proportions given the film's subject. In his new film, Utopia, looks at the Aboriginal population in Australia, prison rates, and some serious problems that are going on with that population. But, of course, also our listeners know John Pilger is a longtime outspoken proponent of free press principles, longtime supporter of the public's right to information. And, again, John Pilger joins us this morning to talk about the state of the free press. John Pilger, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Good morning, Mickey and Peter.
Hi, John. It's good to hear from you.
You too.
Tell us briefly about your new movie now. You're working on a film called Utopia, which addresses issues in Australia, particularly how Western Australia is one of the richest states in the world in terms of resources, iron ore, gold, nickel, oil, petroleum, and all of that has been, you know, billions of dollars of profits. But then the indigenous people, the Aborigines who are living there, have suffered greatly because of this. So you're making a film on this. Tell us about how that's coming.
Yeah. Well, it's where I come from originally. So there's a particular interest and passion about the subject. I made a film called The Secret Country many years ago about Australia. It's a universal story, and you close your eyes, you could be in the United States, Canada. It's about the exploitation of resources at the expense of the indigenous population. Australia has just been declared by the OECD to be recession-free, one of the happiest countries in the world. That may be so, but certainly it's not for its indigenous people, which is Australia's dirty secret. Western Australia, which you mentioned, is the home of the world's biggest mining boom. Western Australia, which is the size of two or three Texases, has just about every kind of mineral wealth. It's also home to those Aboriginal clans and tribes that have survived over several hundred years of effective genocide in Australia. So the mining is going on at the expense of these people. And how do they deal with the people? Well, the Inspector of Custodial Services, as he's called in Western Australia, has just declared that state a state of imprisonment. It has the highest prison rate in the world, nine times higher than apartheid South Africa. And most of those prisoners are black Aboriginal Australians, who represent about 3% of the population. So it's one of those hidden stories that tells us a great deal about the imposition of great power, great multinational power. All these mining companies are multinationals on ordinary people and their ways of life.
John Pilger, once again, you're telling the story that we would hope that a truly free press would tell, and they're not telling. And for a long, long time, people have relied on you and your work to tell those stories. And this story is centuries old in the making, really, if you look at Western imperialism, the treatment of indigenous peoples in what became the United States. So this is an ongoing tale.
It's a story of colonization. Colonization has pretty much the same characteristics wherever it is. There are great likenesses between what happened in the United States and what happened in Australia. A genocide, an onslaught on the original people, exploitation and so on. In fact, one of the premises of colonization is to eliminate, and that is usually to eliminate the first people of that country. I've always felt that unless we understood that unless we went back to those beginnings of where our modern societies come from, where the word civilization was coined, you know, which has, of course, it's a double-edged meaning, because it means that on the other side, the people are not civilized. So where civilization actually came and drew on its riches and became prosperous, and until we understand the origins of that, I don't think we can really understand what's going on today.
John, you talk about how that Western Australia is one of the premier tourist destinations, and I know that you've traveled also years before in the Southwest and the United States, which is also a very heavy tourist destination, where the indigenous people here and, of course, in Australia have been really repressed, and these stories no longer are simply not out there in any major way. So that people understand the history and the culture of the people that are being dealt with. Is that essentially correct?
Yes, it is. Because if those stories were known, if the truth about what happened to the first peoples of our colonized countries was known, it would intrude on the mythology of our societies, the mythology of uniqueness, of special societies, of exceptionalism, of bringing, as I say, a particular civilization to part of the world. It would undermine that mythology a great deal. So it has to remain, if you like, a kind of open secret. And that's very true in Australia, where, unlike the United States, where there is a very considerable awareness now of Native American history and rights and what happened, in Australia there's almost none. There's almost no understanding. There's an indifference, and quite a cruel indifference. So it's well behind the U.S., it's well behind Canada, it's well behind New Zealand, which has its Maori population. In fact, it's pretty well at the bottom of the list of colonized countries that have indigenous populations, which makes its story quite urgent, I think.
So these mythologies, the dominant culture mythologies that are part of our corporate media complex, we want to switch over and talk about Syria. What are the mythologies about Syria that are so prominent in the corporate media today, and how do you perceive what's going on there?
I think busting myths is probably the great noble cause, really, because here we can rush forward to Syria and the Middle East, which is just overflowing with myths. It's all getting very confused for the myth makers in Syria, the people who were rebelling against the Assad government. Many of them are not very pleasant. In fact, they're extremely unpleasant. And what we're seeing happening in Syria is the dismemberment of one of the most multi-ethnic societies in the Middle East. It's the product itself of colonialism. Its boundaries were drawn, as most of the states in that part of the world were drawn, by the British and the French. But the Assad government, while certainly conforming to the very horrific image of a dictatorship in some respects, also oversees, as I mentioned, a very multi-ethnic and a very delicately balanced society into which this civil war has come. Now, yet again, the so-called great powers, the United States, Britain, France, and the European countries, I suppose, European Union, have backed the so-called rebels. But what this means is that they've exacerbated a civil war and may well have spelt the end of this delicate balance of multi-ethnic groups in that country. And I think until we understand that, we on the outside are never going to be in a position to pressure our governments either to back off or to take part in what used to be called diplomacy. It's a word we almost never hear about these days. The ultimate irony of Syria is that we've seen the Russians, the inheritors of the Soviet Union, who have engaged for their own reasons, in their own interests, of course, but they have engaged in diplomacies. And it doesn't seem to me to be all that impossible for the United States and the Russians to engage, and using the facility of the United Nations and all the rest of the reserves of expertise that there still must be in the world, to bring about some kind of, if not resolution, but a slowing down, perhaps bringing us towards a resolution in Syria. The alternative is just too horrific, as we're seeing now. It's horrific right now.
We're talking to John Pilger. You can go to his website, johnpilger.com, to see more. John, you wrote a piece in March, "The New Propaganda is Liberal, The New Slavery is Digital." And this is pertaining to what's going on in places like Libya and Syria. We've really seen a more or less NATO lockstep kind of propaganda about what's going on there, even in some of the alleged progressive press. You've long critiqued propaganda and media as propaganda. What's your take on what's going on here? And let's segue some of this in terms of what we've learned from some of the WikiLeaks cables and some of that.
My sense is that until we understand that the most potent propaganda is that which comes from the most reputable sources, we'll never really understand the power of modern propaganda. Too much we look to the accredited bad guys, the Murdochs, the Fox News, the sort of cartoon propaganda, and I don't wish to underestimate its influence. It's very great indeed. The Murdoch Empire has monopolies all over the world, so it plays a very big part in this propaganda. But my observations as a journalist working within the mainstream, certainly in this country, in Britain, is that the most forceful and the most manipulative propaganda, ultimately the most powerful propaganda, comes from the likes of the BBC, the New York Times, and what I would call the liberal end, or what calls itself, I suppose, the liberal end of the media. Because there's so much else on the other side that is just simply not believable. But when the New York Times speaks, it's meant to be believable. When the BBC broadcasts, it's meant to be believable. And yet, in both organizations and in other organizations, media organizations like it, there's a facade of objectivity behind which there is the propaganda of the state. All the wars, for example, in the last, a dozen years or so, going back to the first Gulf War in 1991, so we're over 22 years ago, have been promoted vigorously by all these reputable news organizations. For example, a couple of very credible surveys found that the BBC gave less airtime to those questioning and opposing the invasion of Iraq than any other broadcasting organization in the West. And now that would surprise a lot of people, especially in the United States, who actually look to the BBC as somewhat more credible, perhaps, than some of the U.S. media organizations. I think that's very important to understand, that when we understand that and when we start to deconstruct the kind of propaganda that we don't yet regard as propaganda, then I think we then begin to understand the sheer pervasiveness, the scale of propaganda in free societies. It's something that many have written about. Noam Chomsky and Robert Chesney and others have, Ed Herman, and it's something that's a terribly urgent issue for us, because the old truth of information being power, our power, applies today more than ever.
John, you know, I'm not surprised to hear you say that the New York Times and the BBC are one of the most effective propaganda machines in the world, and that imperial power have used multi-ethnic divisions for control worldwide for hundreds of years. This goes back, I mean, even in recent history, of course, to Libya, to Yugoslavia, the various wars that have been defined as humanitarian interventions were, in fact, really stirred up by imperial powers in many ways. So you recently have met with Julian Assange, and the WikiLeaks have been a big expose of the manipulations that the imperial powers are engaging in, particularly the United States. What does he have to say about it, and how do you feel about what's happening with him?
One of the reasons that Julian Assange upset so many people in the likes of the New York Times and the BBC and other organizations and liberal organizations is that he and his own organization, WikiLeaks, have shamed so many of those whose job has been to keep the record straight and who haven't done that job. I think over the last couple of years, WikiLeaks has told more people around the world how their governments have lied in secret, various degrees of importance, than most newspapers have in my lifetime. I mean, the whole issue of whistleblowing. Whistleblowers, you know, since I've been an investigative journalist, whistleblower as a source has been the absolute lifeblood of my job. Most of the time, we don't get really hard facts, really hard information from simple journalism. We get it from whistleblowers who give it to journalists. And that's why this assault on WikiLeaks, the so-called trial of Bradley Manning, the assault on whistleblowers by the Obama administration is so important. Here's a president who is prosecuting more whistleblowers than all previous presidents combined. Not even George Bush has approached Obama's record. And because great power now understands, it always did, but now it really understands, it's got the technology to understand it even more, that whistleblowing and the journalism that supports it represents real freedom. And we talked earlier about mythology, the kind of freedom that comes out of great state apparatuses, such as the U.S. administration, is mythology. The real freedom comes from people who are truth tellers, who are invariably whistleblowers.
John Pilger, we're going to have to wrap it up there, and that's a fine note to end on, whistleblowers as truth tellers, and that's a major theme in our upcoming book, Censored 2014, Fearless Speech in Fateful Times, that we're working on with Andy Lee Roth, and we're, of course, happy to have a piece from you coming into the new book, and we thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to join us today.
You're very welcome.
We've been talking with John Pilger. You can learn more at johnpilger.com. His last movie was The War You Don't See. You can learn more at his website. After a brief musical break, we'll be back with Bo Hodai to talk about a recent study on dissent or terror, how the nation's counterterrorism apparatus, in partnership with corporate America, turned on Occupy Wall Street. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. For the final segment today, we are joined by Bo Hodai, who is author of Dissent or Terror, How the Nation's Counterterrorism Apparatus in Partnership with Corporate America Turned on Occupy Wall Street. The report was published jointly by the Center for Media and Democracy and DBA Press. Hodai is a regular contributor to the Center for Media and Democracy, and you can also see more of this study online at prwatch.org. Bo, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks a lot for having me, Mickey.
This is an incredible study, 80-odd pages or more. Give a brief introduction here for listeners. What exactly was this about?
Well, basically, we're looking at with this report the width and depth of Fusion Center surveillance of the Occupy Wall Street movement nationwide. The primary narrative details the monitoring, surveillance, and suppression of Occupy Phoenix. Of course, it's Phoenix, Arizona. However, there are a number of other discussions in the report. One of the primary discussions is on the role that public-private information sharing partnerships or intelligence sharing partnerships played in this monitoring and even possibly the suppression of activist activities.
Bo, this is Peter Phillips. Hi.
Hi.
I read a major part of your report last night, and I was quite amazed the degree to which Homeland Security, the FBI, working in cooperation with business leaders in various communities all across the country, but particularly Phoenix is what you were talking about.
Yeah.
It was literally the Chamber of Commerce group was advising Homeland Security about how to repress or where, how, what they should do in terms of repressing or even intervening with Occupy. And in a sense, this, I mean, this has nothing to do with terrorism anymore. It's really a turning on the American people with free speech rights and addressing the government. It's a turning on them, utilizing these anti-terrorist establishment that has now been placed in America to do that. So tell us in detail, what happened with Jeremy Dimon? What happened in Phoenix?
The report starts out with an anecdotal lead discussing Jamie Dimon's trip to Phoenix, Arizona. And it was in October, I believe it was October 17th of 2011, Jamie Dimon, J.P. Morgan Chase's director of security, contacted a detective at the Phoenix Police Department by the name of Jennifer O'Neill. And Jennifer O'Neill, in addition to being a Phoenix Police Department Bureau of Homeland Defense detective, is also the coordinator of the Arizona Counterterrorism Information Center Community Liaison Program. And the Arizona Counterterrorism Information Center, ACTIC, is, you know, more commonly known as the Arizona Fusion Center. This Community Liaison Program is a program that was created to work with private sector allies and the gathering and sharing of intelligence related to terrorist threats, primarily with the objective of critical infrastructure, key resources, protection. And typically, you know, critical infrastructure, key resources, people might think of dams or nuclear power plants, things like that. Anyways, so Jamie Dimon, chief of security, contacts this ACTIC community liaison program coordinator and says, hey, Mr. Diamond's coming to town. He's going to have a town hall type event for 2,000 of his employees at Diamondback Field in Phoenix. I guess basically the idea was they wanted to see if there was any sort of Occupy Phoenix plans in the work that might discomfort the president and CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase. So the email records we have show that Jennifer O'Neill went on to monitor basically the online activities of members of Occupy Phoenix to see if indeed they had any plans, because, of course, like many Occupy groups, Occupy Phoenix was very active in social media, posting a lot of their plans that we, you know, through Facebook and other things. And she reported back to the J.P. Morgan Chase director of security that it doesn't appear that Occupy Phoenix is even aware that Dimon is coming to town. So, you know, basically it looks like you guys are safe. And, you know, by safe, I mean they're safe from, you know, any embarrassing protests.
Bo Hodai, you're talking about the FBI Operation Tripwire as well, this
right.
effort to monitor. I mean, these are very COINTELPRO-like kinds of operations. Also, more revelations of eavesdropping and government spying on people's records. I mean, it's almost impossible for people to ignore that this kind of thing is happening, even though not long ago, if you suggested such things, you would be an outlandish conspiracy theorist. Here's all the evidence, and in Dissent or Terror, the study, we urge people to read this study at Center for Media and Democracy, PRWatch.org, Lisa Graves and the great crew there. We urge people to go read that. This is going on, and you factually demonstrate this in your piece.
Yeah, and, you know, it's interesting also to mention the FBI, you know, on the heels of our discussion on Jamie Dimon in Arizona, because the FBI actually had gone around, according to records we got from the FBI through a FOIA request, had actually gone to the security personnel of Zions Bank in Salt Lake City, Utah, on the very day that Occupy Salt Lake City was launched. And they were warning this director of security for Zions Bank, that actors sympathetic with Anonymous, I believe is the wording they used, had, quote, doxed Jamie Dimon and Lloyd Blankfein. You know, it says right in the report, the FBI report, that doxing means the posting of public information on the Internet. And I looked at that and I thought, you know, this must be a typo. I mean, what's the FBI care if people are posting public information about bankers on the Internet? It sounds perfectly legal. As a matter of fact, as journalists, that's what we do every day. And I checked into it, and that's, as a matter of fact, all it was. I mean, it was all publicly available information that somebody had assembled into a document and posted on Pastebin about, you know, respectively, Jamie Dimon and Lloyd Blankfein. It's just incredible to see that the FBI was making it their business to warn bankers of legal activity. And then when you look at it in the context of all these other public-private partnerships, public-private intelligence-sharing partnerships that we see in the world of, you know, purported counterterrorism, It really makes a lot of sense, and it's very unfortunate, of course, that it makes as much sense as it does.
This idea of doxing somebody, all that is taking public information and making it perhaps more public. If you're
right.
Ahead of a bank that's got a giant bailout, or you're accused of being involved in the LIBOR scandal of manipulating the credit card rates and stuff for the public, what's really concerning to me in this report was what's called the Domestic Security Alliance Council. So this is national. And this council is made up of the FBI and Homeland Security. But some 29 corporations, including MasterCard, Citigroup, American Express, Barclays, Walmart. This is corporate America interacting at the highest levels with Homeland Security and the FBI. Repressing citizens' rights, essentially, and preempting. This isn't about terrorism at all. This is about domestic control of the American people.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go right ahead. This is your report here.
Well, I was going to say, you know, another thing that sort of speaks to their motives, because like you said, you know, after all, what we're talking about is the monitoring and suppression of constitutionally protected rights. And so something that's interesting to note, speaking to, you know, the motivations of some of these corporate actors involved in DSAC, for example, the Domestic Security Alliance Council, is one of the records that we got, one of the very few records that we got from the FBI relating to DSAC, was a report. Actually, the origin of the report was unknown, but it was responsive to a DSAC request. And given the fact that it was a Coast Guard-issued report in FBI records, given the involvement of DHS and DSAC as a partnership with the FBI and the private sector, it appears that it's most likely a DSAC report. But anyways, in this report, they're speaking about possibilities of interruption to supply chains for, you know, basically commercial retailers as being a primary concern related to the Occupy protests involving ports in November and December of 2011, the shutdown the ports idea.
That was, of course, the Oakland port was shut down for 14 hours. There were threats of other closures around the country. This certainly got the FBI up in arms and Homeland Security.
Right. I believe it was in the context of the Oakland port. They were saying something to the effect of, if it spreads to San Diego, I believe, we could be looking at severe supply chain disruptions.
Bo Hodai, then in a nutshell here, dissent or terror, you're talking about infiltration, surveillance without criminal predicate. You're talking about public-private intelligence sharing partnerships, counterterrorism, Homeland Security, branding Occupy groups or anti-NDAA groups and so on as terrorist threats. And you're really talking about what, let's just break it down, a fascist culture police state violating people's constitutional rights.
Right, and it certainly is, you know, contained in the documents that we got discussed in the report. You know, it's evidence of the realization of so many fears that people who are politically engaged, people who are engaged in the system, have feared, especially with NDAA, you know, that they might be labeled as terrorists or, you know, under the very broad language of NDAA, you know, and aiding against hostilities against the nation. And then, in fact, we did find a number of communications and materials we obtained discussing FBI monitoring of NDAA protest groups, Fusion Center, of course, in Arizona, as well as the U.S. Capitol Police.
And this is thousands of people, thousands of police officers around the country in your city. You found that there were 70 anti-terrorist police officers in various communities in Arizona. So we can imagine that's just every
800.
800. So it's just thousands nationwide. So we're just about out of time here. But do you have a last word, Bo?
How about a place you can direct people so they can go and read this amazing study?
The report can be found at the CMD websites, SourceWatch and mm-hmm. PR Watch.
Mm-hmm. PRWatch.org.
Right, and SourceWatch.org. And the source materials behind the report, the vast majority of them, or a large majority of them, are currently available on the website that I published, dbapress.com.
Okay. Thanks, Bo Hodai, for your work as an investigative journalist. We hope people check out your study, Dissent or Terror. You've been listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. This is Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Special thanks to Anthony Fest. We hope you join us next time.